Hey everyone, how are you? Welcome to this week's episode of our podcast. It's called Is Breakfast Included? Thank you for stopping by. Can you hear that behind me? That's the big game being played. I can't say the S word, but it's the big game. I'm here and you're jealous. And it's two sports ball teams that are playing and I have no clue who they are, but I'm here. You're not. On the show today, I talk with Greg Souders. Greg is a founding member and drummer for the band The Long Riders. He is the senior vice president of A&R and catalogs for Warner Chappell Music. He's held that position for over 33 years, and he's the co-president of Limited Edition Music Publishing. Above all that, Greg is my friend, and I'm happy to call him that. He took time out of a busy day, the day after the Grammys, to talk to me and tell me a little bit about his gig and what he does for a living. We had a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoy it. Let's check it out. Tell everyone who you are and what you do.
Well, hey, Bernie, and hey, everybody. My name's Greg Souders, and I'm the senior vice president of A&R and catalogs for Warner Chappell Music here in Los Angeles. And I'm also the co-president of Limited Edition Music Publishing, which is a smaller, more boutique-y publishing company that also goes through Warner Chappell. And probably what I'm most proud of is I'm a drummer and one of the founding members of a rock and roll band from Los Angeles called The Long Riders. And The Long Riders have been going over 40 years, and I've been here at Chappell almost 33 years.
Right on, man. So you got your gig at Warner Chappell not too long after The Riders were The Riders started.
Well, most drummers need day jobs, so I found and they go pretty well together.
I was looking up. I was after I met you, I looked up The Long Riders, and you guys just released an album in 2023, correct?
Yeah, a record called September November, and it's maybe our seventh or eighth album. We've been together a long time. We took mostly the 90s off. I think we just, like a lot of bands, just had to take a break from each other. But we kept putting out records and compilations and live records and box sets. And then we started touring again a bunch in the early 2000s. And in the last 4 or 5 years, we've been making new albums pretty regularly. So the most recent, yeah, is September, November.
All right. So you never really broke up. You just took a break.
Well, we thought we broke up, but it turned out we didn't. we yelled at each other a whole bunch. And, you know, most bands, except for maybe, you know, the Stones or U2's a great example, it's hard to keep a band together for a lot of, not just financial reasons, but really more social stuff. It's like brothers and sisters in a fight. And, when you grow up together, people change. They grow up, they start families, a lot of things happen, you know, as you grow older. And I think for the Long Riders, after we took some time off, we used to, you know, we'd fight about money and relationships, you know, all that stuff. And I think when you figure out, again, minus saying the super superstars, for the most part, money's not really the reason you get together to play music, and eventually you run out of it. So you need something deeper to keep a band of brothers together, and that's the musical and spiritual connection. And I think that's what the Long Riders discovered after some time apart, that better together, that we loved each other and brought out the best in each other musically and philosophically and spiritually.
Right on. And these days, do you guys communicate better? Can you have a conversation without somebody getting offended? Or
yes, that's a great question, Bernie. When you're with somebody, whether it's a one-on-one relationship or a band, and you know you've been around both, it's easy that the wrong look or the wrong word at the wrong time, and all the nuclear weapons come out, and you're fighting about something that happened 30 years ago. We had a fight one day on this record. Argument, discussion, whatever you want to call it. And it didn't take long to go from you mixed this record 35 years ago without asking my permission, and that's why I'm still mad at you. So, you know, you have to have a sense of humor and be able to shake it off and realize that you're together for a higher calling to make art, really.
Yeah. When I was doing some research on the Long Riders, you guys were labeled as the Paisley Underground, which I had never heard that term. And then it right next to it was like alternative country. And that's what I heard when I looked your band up. It was more alternative. What is Paisley Underground? Was that a term that...
Yeah, so, you know, movements, scenes, whatever, we call it comp scenes, they always need to have a name and a thing. Yeah. And it's good to have culture around a band or an artist when they start, you know, who your fans are. And in the early 80s in Los Angeles, there was kind of a loose group of bands that worked together. Bands like the Dream Syndicate, the Bangles when they first started, the Long Riders, another group called the Rain Parade at 3 o'clock. And they were kind of loosely affiliated. First of all, we played shows together. We were friends. It's cool to have a scene. It's like coming from the early punk scene, you know, in the mid and late 70s in Britain and London, or, you know, like the Stones popping out of the R&B and, you know, end of traditional jazz scene in London. And those kind of New York in the late 70s, Ramones, Talking Heads, Patti Smith, television, all those CBGB bands. They didn't sound alike, but they had a similar aesthetic, a similar view about music and art. And that's what happened out here. There was a little bit of a influence of some sort of 60s and 70s psychedelic things, garage bands. And when the Long Riders formed, we had a slightly different take. We were more guilty by association. We really had been listening to the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers, you know, and Clarence White on guitar, the Band, of course, always Bob Dylan. But we also were listening to Merle Haggard and Waylon Jennings, of course, always Johnny Cash, you know, Willie Nelson a little bit. Doug Somm was a big influence on us, a great Texas blues and country guy, Doug Somm. So we threw that in the blender next to the psychedelic rock and roll stuff. And they said we were kind of one of the forefathers of the alternative country scene or Americana scene. Mm-hmm. We always said, well, sorry, we didn't mean to start that. And we didn't do it on purpose. We really were just trying to follow the through line from the guys, the people that came before us, you know, Linda Ronstadt, Emmylou Harris. But because of when we grew up, we played our songs really fast with a lot of intensity. So as much as we loved Merle Haggard and Doug Somm and Graham Parsons, we also loved the Ramones and X. They were like our big brothers in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And bands that put the pedal to the metal a little bit.
Well, I was checking out one of my favorite tunes is the Fine Wild Son. Like,
yeah,
right out of the gate on Native Son, man, that song just kicks you right in the teeth.
I'm glad you like that. So that song is, yeah, Final Wild Son. Our guitar player, Sid Griffin, wrote that, and he wrote it about Jerry Lee Lewis. It's kind of a narrative about him, the final wild son coming out of Faraday, Louisiana, and he was like a bat out of hell. We love Jerry Lee. And when we made that song, it's a fast song, so we played fast, that kind of two-step thing. But our guitar player, who still plays with Stephen McCarthy, he came out from Richmond, Virginia, L.A., and he was going to be a bass player in a country band. He didn't even have a guitar when he met us. He answered an ad in the newspaper, you know, band seeks guitar player, you know, Ramones, Doug Somm, Clash, and Graham Parsons influence, something like that. And he showed up, and he really was a country boy. He wasn't a hillbilly, but he was a country boy. And we were L.A. rock and roll guys. And so he didn't even have a guitar. He borrowed a guitar for the audition. And it turned out he was a better player than we were. We were lucky to be in a band with him. And he was playing like on that Fender Telecaster, all that B-bender kind of stuff, like Clarence White would play, you know, kind of replicate pedal steel sound, but on the guitar. And Dave Edmunds was using that a little bit in England. Ronnie Wood uses one in the Stones, but Stephen was really good at it. And because he was from the American South, he kind of had that sort of twist on it. And so he joined up with Sid Griffin and me, and we made Final Wild Son. And the guy on that record, the bass player, is a guy named Tom Stevens, who passed away about 3 years ago. He was our brother, and he died of natural causes, which kind of blew our mind, because when you're kids, somebody in your band dies, it's unnatural causes, you know, unfortunately. Usually it freaks you out. Now we're getting older, and guys are dying of regular shit, as they say. So it was a shock. It was sad to say goodbye to our friend Tom, but he left this great legacy of rock and roll. And I know it's a long answer, but this record that Final Wild Son is on, It's called Native Sons. It came out 40 years ago. It's an anniversary. So we just put out a new box set to commemorate that record with some cool live stuff and some demos and outtakes and some nice pictures. It's nice that it just remembers our first album was from 40 years ago now.
Yeah. And so, yeah, when I went back and started listening to you guys, that, you know, I always try and start from the beginning. And yeah. And I did kind of make my way through, but I kept finding my way back to Native Son. Just kept finding my way back there. That's, you know, it's been on constant play since I looked you guys up.
Well, you have impeccable taste, Bernie. So
thank you.
But that was kind of the beginning. We recorded that record with a guy named Henry Louis, who's also passed away. I mean, he was old then, but kind of a famous record producer that had worked with. He'd moved to Los Angeles to get away from Germany in World War II and joined the Musicians Union as a tambourine player. Kind of cool. And he started working in the 60s with like the Mamas and Papas and with the Wrecking Crew. He did a little work with that whole Phil Spector scene. And he started producing the Flying Burrito Brothers. And then he did all Joni Mitchell's big records, you know, all of her classics and among other things. So really a cool old jazz guy. He used to bring the strongest weed I'd ever smoked, let alone seen, to these sessions. He was older than all of us, and we couldn't play after Henry got
done. Was it all red and sticky?
Crazy, man. Henry really, he was a force of nature. We made that record at A&M Studios right next door to Tom Petty, which was fun. He was working. And it was just a great scene, man. And Gene Clark sang on that record on a song called Ivory Tower. The late, great Gene Clark from the Byrds. He was one of our heroes. And Sneaky Pete Kleinow, the pedal steel player, also from the Flying Burrito Brothers. He played on some stuff. So it was a fun record.
Yeah. When you said earlier you guys had a scene, like when I played, I'm from Dallas, and there was a scene in the 90s when I came up. And there's nothing better than a good music scene. And I mean, you know, nobody's doing it for everybody wants that break, but no one's doing it for any ulterior motive. It's just to play music. And on any given night, you're seeing all these great bands. Is that what it was like when you were coming up?
Yeah, there was a few clubs that really supported it, like the really smaller ones that you would kind of cut your teeth in and then work your way up to a, you know, like the Troubadour or a band. There was an old club in Los Angeles, gone now, called Club Lingerie. And that's where there was a scene. And yeah, you knew if you either played there or you would go down there to support your friends, or if there was a cool band from out of town, REM or The Replacements, something like that, you'd go see them. And, you know, you go down there, everybody dressed the same. It was fun. It was like a little kika, man. It was, you know, where it was at. And that's, you're part of a tribe. And I think that's one of the great things about music, any style of music, is tribalism in a good way. Sometimes that gets a bad rub, that word. But tribalism is, you know your crew, your people, you come together. But the trick is, all are welcome. It's not exclusive, it's inclusive. So like, hey, we all love blues music, or we all love country music, or we all love punk rock. And we come together. And then, like in the early days in LA, the scene was very inclusive, and a lot of different cats would show up. Like, you'd look over and see, oh, there's the guy from Black Flag, or there's Keith Morris, or there's the, you know, the dudes from, there's Dwight Yoakam, who's a Stone Country guy. He'd be at the show. Or there's some guys from New Orleans that were in town. There's Ziggy Modolese playing, or whatever. And people would come together, but they knew that LA had this little scene going on. So people were always showing up. It was fun.
Yeah. I remember hearing about Dwight Yoakam doing shows with like Husker Du.
Yes. You know, that's right.
And it was a normal thing there.
Dwight had good taste, man. He liked punk rock and he liked country. And, you know, if you listen, he has a great show on Sirius XM radio called the Bakersfield Beat in the States. And it's cool. Dwight has great taste in music, and he'll tell you himself.
He'll tell you a lot of things about himself.
He'll tell you a lot of things. That's right. That's why we love him.
Right. So, man, how did you get into the A&R business? How'd you get your start?
It's been a minute. But I'll tell you, I never expected to stay in the game this long, Bernie. It kind of happened. When the Long Riders, when we took our first break, we said, we can't do this anymore. We had been on Island Records, and we got off the label, and, you know, you get a little discouraged between hits, as they say.
Yeah.
Or instead hits. And so I was working back then when the Long Runs were starting. I actually had been married to a great country singer, or Americana, the kind of the grand dame out of the family, a woman named Lucinda Williams. Great, great art. I mean, I love her. We're just not married anymore. But it was cool. So anyway, it was the end of everything. That marriage was finishing up, winding down, as we like to say. And the Long Riders were taking a break. And so I found myself driving a forklift in a warehouse, which was, you know, to be a rock star one minute and driving a forklift the next, it's humbling. It yeah. really was humbling. But it's, but you know, you're, if it doesn't kill you, as they say, right? So yeah. it literally made me stronger. And I got married again. I like getting married. I've been married a few times, baby. So I got married again. And the woman I was married to was great. She said, you're wasting your time driving around this forklift. You need to get back in the music business. So back then, this is in the late 80s, you know, there was no internet yet. So I answered a news magazine ad in this magazine called The Hollywood Reporter. You know, it was an industry rag, as they used to say. A help wanted music company, whatever the hell that means. So I had a call from a payphone in this warehouse. And, you know, there's a power tools, a guy's yelling, and they're all crying out, like, shut up. This is my shot, man. And the woman, I got an interview at the company was BMI, like ASCAP, yeah. BMI in LA. And the woman that interviewed me, she says, you clearly have no professional or business experience whatsoever, but I'm going to take mercy on you. I know you like music and I like musicians. So she hired me and I got a job as an assistant at BMI. I don't know how to do anything, man. I knew how to play the drums, but I didn't know how to type. I don't know how to you had to take dictation, letter, everything, all the business stuff. I didn't know S-H-I-T about any of that, but I knew about music. And as you've probably seen, and unfortunately, there's quite a few people in the music business that spend more time on the business than the music. So I kind of looked around. I thought, you know, my secret weapon is that I know and love music. That shouldn't be a secret weapon. That should be the first line in your resume.
Yeah.
But it was, people were shocked. And so I learned some of the business part of it, but I knew about the music. I just waited for my shot. So I got a friend of a friend, a woman who again took pity on me. She was offered a job at Warner Chappell Music in 1991, and she was getting ready to marry somebody and move. So she said, you don't know this guy, but you should hire him. I got an interview. And I went up to Warner Chappell. I had one suit, weddings, funerals, and interviews.
Of course.
Right? Of course. And the guy that interviewed me was asking me about the Beach Boys, the Rolling Stones, and Doug Somm, and, you know, and the Meters, and the Wild Chappell, too. Like, man, I said, I can't. Where have you been all my life? Here's a guy that knows music. And they hired me to pitch songs for movies. It was the film and TV department. And they hired me, gave me a shot. One guy wasn't going to hire me. He said, I'm not going to hire a guy in a suit. I said, man, the one time I wore a suit, it was going to fuck me up. I couldn't believe it. I said, I swear I don't have, I just, that's not me. But I was trying to be respectful. So the guy said, I don't worry about it. He's not really a suit guy. So I got this job and I was in a building on Sunset Boulevard and I had a view of the city. It was right across the street from the Roxy. And I said, I can't believe I got an A&R. It wasn't really A&R. It was film and TV, but I listened to music all day and it was great. I would listen to songs I liked that Warner Chappell published. So it was everything from Ray Charles to Curtis Mayfield to James Brown to Led Zeppelin and Eric. It's a huge, great old catalog. And I learned what the power of hit songs were. Sometimes A&Rs don't really look past the tip of their own nose. And I knew between my own record collection and having been a musician still working and my great love of music, it was perfect. So by the time, and then there was a guy that was in New York. He was the head of A&R. He came to LA and he said, I want to move you to A&R. I want you to sign it. I think you'll be good at signing artists, songwriters that are artists. And I thought, I want to sign somebody signed Madonna. Somebody signed, you know, the Rolling Stones. Somebody signed the Beatles. They weren't famous when they signed them.
Yeah.
See, somebody took a chance and they could hear a great song. And being a drummer, this comes back to being a drummer. I always say being a drummer and a music publisher, I'm basically a song and dance man, you know, when you're a drummer, you get your report card every song. People either move around or they don't. And songs, you know, as a drummer, you know pretty quickly if a song is worth playing or not. You just know. You could just hear it and feel it. So that was a good background to have to be a publisher. And I started working with songwriters and started thinking about not just one hit wonders or, you know, pop here today, gone tomorrow, but what does a career look like? And that's the first band I signed was the Black Crowes. I saw them in 1991. Their first record was out. I knew them because they used to come and see the Longriders play. They're just young brothers. And that went great. I was off to a pretty good start. And then I started doing A&R full time. And it really was, and there's two parts to publishing. There's people that sign staff writers that are writing with and for other people. I'm more of an artist guy. So I would work with artists that wrote their own material. And it really just, I just had some, you always need luck in A&R. But you got to be able to hear a song and you got to understand what we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, Bernie, about a culture and a scene, just like the Paisley Underground. So I would look for artists, whether they were solo artists or bands, that were part of a cultural scene. They had a fan base. Even today, when you look online, it's okay. It still has to be part of something. That's why I'm not as big on the one-hit wonder TikTok kids. There's nothing wrong with getting your music out there any way you can. It's faster than the old days of playing one city at a time, but you need to have a base. You need to be part of something. Pop is fine. It can be anything. Country. I've signed everything from Katy Perry to Nickelback to the Deftones, you know, to the Linda Lindas, to Black Crowes, to, you know, Portugal the Man, just Smashing Pumpkins. So I've always hopped across genre lines. But the one thing all those artists had in common is they were best in class. And I tried to find them early, early, early.
Yeah. It's funny. You said something. You have to have a culture. I think I told you over breakfast the other day that, you know, in my younger days, that's kind of what I aspired to be, was an A&R guy. Of course, yeah. Coming from Corsicana, Texas, I didn't know my way out of the city limits, to be honest with you. But I would read articles and I'd listen to albums. And there were a couple of bands at the time, a band called Cry of Love. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
I remember, yes.
They were such a good band, but I always said it wasn't their season when they got signed. And
yeah.
And I don't know if that's what you mean by the culture, or like, you know, it just wasn't their time. They were either ahead of their time or just missed it by a little.
Sometimes you just miss it. Sometimes it's just because your songs just aren't good enough, you know, for whatever reason. Sometimes you just miss it. I've signed people or been around things, and we all had our favorites that like that. They were great. It just didn't hit. That's that luck thing, timing, whatever. I always again, I feel like being a drummer, timing is something that is good. Time has been on my side, you know, and you just have a feeling. I've had people ask me, like, well, how do you know? They always ask me, what's the definition of a hit song? Because it is still a hit-driven business. Not to make art. You don't need that to validate your art, but as a commercial venture. However, whether it's in the old days, it was records or CDs, radio. Now streaming is really the way to gauge if your song is connecting. But to me, a definition of a hit is just, it's a song that as soon as you hear it, you want to hear it again. You know, so whether you're clicking on Spotify or Apple or on YouTube, or, you know, used to be listening on the radio, hoping it would come on again. And it's a simple definition for me. And that way you don't get stuck with, you know, trying to figure it out too much.
Do you, you don't have to answer this, but I'll ask you anyway, was there a band that you signed that you felt really had it, that just didn't, I'm not going to, for lack of a better term, deliver, but just didn't quite achieve what you kind of saw in them?
Yeah, hell yes. In A&R, they're not all hits, baby. You know, there's a saying there, we bury our dead very deeply out in the forest, going out in the unmarked graves, you know.
Out in the desert.
A lot of holes in the desert. If you have a hit, we like to let everybody know. It's easier for me because I'm not a songwriter. Again, I'm a drummer. I'm an accompanist, really, and a publisher. So I've never had that thing like, well, I could write. You know, I have a lot of A&R friends can get a little bitter. I could have wrote that. That's a piece of shit. That's terrible. I said, man, no, you couldn't. You didn't. You know, you're lucky to be an A&R. And I think that the art of A&R, by the way, sorry, the band that I think one band I actually met and they were friends with the Black Crowes. I developed them from scratch. They were called Terraplane. You've never heard of them. I got them signed to Maverick, got them a publisher deal, got them great shows. And it just couldn't get it over the hump. It was kind of like a blues rock band from mid-90s. I just couldn't get it there. And it wasn't for lack of trying, but I was always disappointed, you know, that it didn't happen for them. I'm sure they were actually a little more disappointed than I was, you know.
I'm sure.
but I tried.
Had the Crowes.
I had the Crowes. I always have worked hard. But I think that in A&R, you have to learn to listen. You have to have a good instinct. It really is an instinct. Now it's not as necessarily as much about going. In the old days, you'd go to a club, you'd get there early, or you'd go see a band play that you liked. I'd always try to go early to see who the opening act was because I'd think, well, if they're good enough to be on the bill with this band that I want to sign, it's like when you're a kid, you go to see, you know, whatever, the band, you'd always go see who's the opening act. You just assumed, oh, well, if Elton John likes them or if U2 likes them enough to put on the bill, they must be cool. I'll go check them out. And then you would get turned on to new bands or certain DJs on the radio, underground FM DJs would play stuff. But I would go to clubs and see the opening act, get there early and see what was up. That's an old A&R trick. You check it out early. And then, of course, if something was hot, and this is when you would go see live music. I still go all the time because I love it. But as a scouting tool to go see something. As I became more successful, some of the more lazy A&Rs or people that aren't as sure of their ears would look around and see, oh, well, if Greg likes it or Bernie likes it, I like it too. I'll offer more money and I'll sign them. They've already done the hard work because if they like it, it's got to be good. So if I saw something I liked, I would make sure I would tell the guys ahead of time, I'll go see you in another town. But in LA, I'm going to watch your show and leave early so that everybody thought I didn't like it. and then the lazy A&R say, well, it must not be any good. He left early. And I'd go back and see him in Denver or San Diego or wherever.
Yeah.
Sign him. Now the search for A&R is a little different. There's different tools. You know, you're looking on Spotify or you're looking on SoundCloud or you're looking at, you know, anywhere online and you're looking at the metrics to see when things go up spike, which is good. It helps you. It's like, those are like demo tapes in the old days, sorting through demo tapes, seeing what's spiking. But you still need to be able to assess the talent, see, is it going to have long-term value? Can I help them make a record, help them find a different producer, maybe add co-writers? Do they have a label or partners management team that can deliver for them, get them on the right tours? So sometimes A&R isn't just about signing a band. It's really helping develop them, giving them advice on making a record, trying to assess talent, trying to see where they're going to go with it, you know, have some awareness of marketing, and then to really know how to move something when you sign an artist, whether it's a publisher or a record company or label, how to move them through the system.
Yeah.
How do you same people involved? How do you get international involved? How do you get marketing? How do you make it something that the whole company is excited about, not just me?
Yeah.
Kiss of death is when you would get signed to a label or a publisher and they would say, oh, the head of the company is signing me. He loves the chairman or the chairwoman, whoever she loves me. She's going to be my person. That's never good because they're too busy.
Yeah.
So makes you sense. Need to have somebody, a younger A&R or somebody that has time and experience that will devote to you as the artist.
Yeah. So in like, I don't know if it's the right way to say it. The heyday of A&R, like you said, the going to the club, was that all about, you know, the company card? I'm gonna take you out as guys out to dinner. Wow. I mean, there were legendary A&R guys, you know, present company included. Did you do all that back in the day? Did you go to when you saw the Deftones? Did you go up to them and go, hey, let's go out for drinks? Let's go out for
Yes, of course. So I wore that expense credit card out, you know. ironically, you know, some years ago, I stopped drinking myself, but you know, sometimes an occupational hazard for people in the business, and I may have been a little too good at entertaining, so I finally had to make some changes. It's amazing how my expenses did go down at some point. I might have been spending more money than the artist, so it's important. this is what I've learned over time. At first, you just want to hang out because the artists are your peers. You're all young. You're all together. You want to, you have a lot in common culturally, you know, pop music. Well, y'all are doing the same things. As you get a little older in the business and the inexperience of youth and the enthusiasm of youth is sort of replaced by experience. So if I'm going to spend time with an artist or a songwriter and go out, you want to socialize, you want to build a good relationship. But I also will start to talk to them about their music and find out what it is that that's really important to them. And which everybody should do, even the younger A&Rs, but then to try to take that information and help guide them into making smart choices on songwriting or on making a record, or if they're trying to hire different people for the team. And then again, to represent them. Sometimes the younger A&Rs, once they've made the record, they don't necessarily know how to be an advocate within their company. Maybe they don't have to be, but at my company, at Warner Chappell, it's a big international company. So to have an advocate that can connect with the songwriters and the artists and also be able to move through the company and build good alliances within the rest of the team, international team, you know, and so that we, this new music that the artists and songwriters work so hard on, that we can help it get connected to the people that can make a difference within the company.
That being said, do you still run into, I spoke to Kevin Martin and the band Candlebox.
I used to work with him. I know.
And he was telling me that he feels that they didn't really know each other when they got the deal. And then the debut album blew up and they got to know each other on the road, then kind of realized, hey, we don't really get along. Does that happen with newer artists that you see? And how does an A&R guy deal with that? How does an A&R guy try and help them keep it together? Like,
yeah, that's cool. That's a good question. I mean, sometimes it's like an arranged marriage. They get together and then they have to get to know each other on the wedding night or out on the road. And that's kind of weird. The other side of that coin is, again, it could be the songwriters or anybody else that after spending a lot of time together, you grow up and you change, not good or bad. You just change it. Sometimes you grow apart and sometimes you just get tired of each other. You know, like I said, and having more than one marriage in my career, sometimes you grow apart, you know?
Yeah.
So for an A&R person, especially if it's a band, you know, it's a group of people. And if you still believe, and I'm not talking about, we got to keep them together because we're going to do greatest hits and we make on the road. I mean, it is a for-profit company.
Yeah.
Whether it's our company or any others for the most part. So you have to always, you're constantly trying to reconcile art with commerce and also what's good for the artist and the songwriters, mental health wise, and all that kind of stuff. So if you, and for me, this is where experience comes into play. If you know that these artists are good together, you still think they have more work they can accomplish, create art, also maybe be commercially successful, make money to support themselves and their family. Of course, the company wants to make money too. You do your best to help them over things. Sometimes it's just talking to them. Sometimes, you know, the two most dreaded words in the English language when they go together are band and meeting. Band meeting. It's frightening. Anything can happen. But sometimes you want to work through, managers really do this, but as an experienced A&R, I've done it a lot too. Almost like a band personality intervention to get people to communicate. Lack of communication is always very, very difficult. And then sometimes you just have to let bygones be bygones. If it's too toxic and too damaging for them to stay together, like a marriage, then you have to support everyone.
Back in the day when bands would get signed, I came up in the 90s, early 2000s. Everyone was looking for that break. Everyone was wanting, and I knew a few bands that got record deals. Are the days over of like, we'll give you $500,000 bonus? You know, are those days gone? Are you just, to record labels more like, hey, we're just going to pay for your album and give you tour support? Or
no, it's both. You know, if they have a music out and it's already success, maybe it's a more mature band that's changing record companies or publishing companies, mm-hmm. and a catalog that comes with them, there's some value there. If it's a new artist who has they haven't made a publishing deal, especially sometimes they'll make a record deal or a label deal before a publishing deal. Maybe they have a couple songs out, they're streaming in the And to really make money in publishing, something has to be streaming other than radio, you know, in the millions, you know, tens, if not hundreds of millions, because the royalty rates are still challenging from the, yeah, what's called DSPs. Working on that, that's another reason to work with big companies. Besides the creative input, is also the professional support that, you know, you have a voice in Congress, you know, so to speak, fighting with, or not necessarily fighting, but negotiating with, you know, the Spotify's and the Apples and YouTube's and BMI and ASCAP, publisher or record company can is your advocate when you're not there. But depending on what you got going, if you have a series of singles or records or albums in the marketplace and money hasn't been collected, royalties are out there, that goes against an advance, so that can increase your advance. But that's always the thing when they say, well, the company's paying them with their own money. They have a new song out and say it's worth $1 million. $1 million in uncollected royalties. Say, well, we'll offer you $1 million advance. They'll say, their representatives will say, cool, but we also want you to give us an advance that reflects your belief in the future in us. They used to call that putting a little skin in the game. So mm-hmm. instead of just paying us with their own money, we want you to put some risk money involved. And the theory is that if you have a financial stake above and beyond the easy money, that you'll be, the company may be more motivated to promote you and work with you because you want to make your advance back. I'm not sure if that's true or not. I think if you had signed somebody to a record deal or a publishing deal as an A&R, what I do, you should be determined to help them and focused regardless of whether you give an advance of, you know, $25,000 or an advance of, you know, $3 or $4 million. You should be equally as motivated. I know that's a little naive to say that, but for me, I have to be dedicated and focused on what the art that they're trying to make to really connect.
I mean, because like any gig, that reflects on you as well. If you're just signing a band and then just moving on to the next one, like,
yeah, there are A&Rs that are missing in action, right? You see them sign and take the picture. Maybe they'll come down to the studio for playback. Then see you at the Grammys or whatever. And that's not that cool. You know, that's not a good look. But
yeah,
some artists and songwriters don't want a lot of creative input from their A&R, from their label. So you have to know how to navigate that too, because you don't want to be completely shut out, not have a relationship. But if they're so good at what they do and you trust them enough, then you have to give them their space, because they don't need to have me down there in the studio telling them, oh, have you thought about using a different ride cymbal or gee, turn the bass down on that track. That's not what everybody, some people do need that, but not everybody. And if you're trying to shoehorn your opinion and your quote unquote expertise into a session that you're not invited, it can create some bad vibes. I always try to wait till I'm invited to a session. And also before I start adding my input, that I've gained the trust of that songwriter with the producer or the artist, and that they want my input because they know it's coming from a more of an experienced, informed place as a experienced A&R, but also as a working musician.
Yeah. Yeah. Since you brought up publishing, let's talk a little bit about that. I bring up Tom Petty a lot because, well, you and I know, we talked about Tom Petty over breakfast. He talks about that big famous battle about his publishing, trying to get his publishing back. He thought when he signed over his publishing, he was signing over the rights to have it in music books. You know, what is publishing? If you could explain it to people who don't understand the whole idea of what publishing is.
So it is tricky. A lot of people, even professionals, don't really understand it. It took me a long time to learn it. I always say there's no dumb questions in music publishing. So whether you're a songwriter or a young publisher or a manager, you should ask questions. People love it when you don't ask questions because they can do whatever they want. I wish everybody had integrity and business. You know, not everybody does. So for me, part of my karma, my rock and roll karma, is to continue to help educate and explain things to young songwriters, and executives and managers that may not know. And so publishing is essentially the business of songs and songwriting. You know, creating the intellectual property, creating songs, and then managing them as an asset. It could be collecting the royalties It could be registering the song so people know who wrote what around the world, especially now with everything's electronic. So the metadata, every song is embedded with the code when it's released so people know who wrote it. And, you know, people may want to use, if you your song is in a movie or a TV show or a commercial, there's a license for the sound recording, you know, the record of it, and there's a license for the songwriter. So if you wrote a song for Taylor Swift, and Taylor Swift sang it, and it's in a Super Bowl commercial for Doritos, Taylor writes her own songs, but if she didn't, you know, they'd have to pay her for the right to the recording or her record company, and they'd have to pay you and your publisher for the right to put it in the commercial. So when you sign a publishing deal, you're saying, in the old days, you sign away, and Tom did for this first couple of albums, he lost the rights. He has the rights for the majority of his catalog, or his estate does, but a lot of times Led Zeppelin did it too. Eric Clapton, when they signed the record deal, the publishing, we're part of the Warner Music, the publishing deal was connected to it. And especially the old blues and R&B guys and the old country guys, they didn't get anything. You know, they were really ripped off on the record side and the publishing side.
The Beatles.
Yeah, so terrible. That's a terrible story. So publishing, it's the song, like if you're a songwriter and you write a song, you're also your own publisher. You could register the songs with BMI or ASCAP. You could put them out. You can let people record them, and you can collect the money. Nowadays, because there's so many different ways to make money, so many what we call micro streams of revenue, that it's good to have a company that's good at it, that knows how to collect the money. So once that song is created, you have to give permission to an artist to record it. You know, if you write a song for Dua Lipa, and she's going to release it, you have to give her permission for the first use. Now, if you do covers after that, anybody can do a cover as long as they don't change the lyrics and melody.
Yeah.
But the first use, the songwriter's control. And so if you make a deal with a publisher, if you say, hey, Greg, I don't have time to take care of my songs. I want to spend all my time being creative, getting cuts from other artists, or writing and recording my own songs, you're my publisher. And then we'll split up the royalties. Sometimes we used to split them 50-50 in the old days. It's not like that anymore. It's usually a different kind of split. And we usually don't own them forever. In the old days, we used to, in perpetuity. Now, a publishing deal is for a very specific amount of time, usually X amount of years, plus recoupment. Another's recoupment of any advances. I might choose to give you an advance against your future royalties. You may or may not want one. So you have to recoup that advance. Doesn't mean you have to stay at the company forever, but you know, it's an interest-free loan. If you don't make your money back, you can leave, but those songs will stay there until you make the money back. Mm-hmm. So a publisher is really, it's supposed to help you administratively collect your royalties, register your songs, license them, let the world know who owns them or who wrote them. And then on the creative side, what I do in A&R, if you're a songwriter or not an artist, my job is to find you, put you with other songwriters to collaborate, set up sessions, and or put you directly involved with artists that want to collaborate, co-write. You'll write songs together. If you write without an artist, then I'll pitch those songs to labels. Hey, I have this great Bernie song, and I'm pitching it to this new pop artist on Republic. So that's called song plugging in the old days. Mm-hmm. That's like, you used to get a song, you'd get the sheet music, you know, Cole Porter would write a song, and take that song, go to Ella Fitzgerald's manager, play it on the piano, great song, they'd record it. So then so that's the creative side, or pitching songs for movies or TV shows. Hey, they're doing a reboot of Star Wars, only it's going to be set in modern times, and they want to have a dance soundtrack of all, you know, DJs and contemporary dancers, that I would pitch those songs.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different things you do. It works with record companies, but it's a separate business.
Okay.
You don't have to have a music publisher, but having a partner in a music publisher can make your life a lot easier.
Did you ever think back in the 80s when you made that phone call that you'd still be doing it in 2024?
No way. I couldn't believe they gave me a chance. No one was looking for me. I grew up in a little house in Atwater, California. It's now called Atwater Village. Was 425 square feet. We had a dirt driveway and a garage that was collapsing. Six of us lived there. My brother slept outside because there wasn't enough room in the house. And I didn't have a lot. I always say we weren't poor, but we were broke. Broke was a condition, poor as a state of mind.
Yeah.
And I might be a little bit on the undereducated side. I might not have gone to school as long as some of the other kids, but I never wanted to do anything else. I only wanted to play music. And then when I found out that there was a job, A&R, that supported that, I couldn't believe that. I feel so fortunate, Bernie. And I'll tell you, the job that I have and being an A&R, it's always gone well with being a musician. And there's not a lot of job security in this field. So it's really a job that's based on results. Like I said, as a drummer, you get your report card. People either dance or they don't. But in A&R, we get our report card every week too. Songs either on the radio or used to be on CDs and sold, charting. Now if it's streaming or if it's in movies, it's a for-profit business. And I work for the songwriters. I'm trying to help you or whoever is a songwriter make money with their songs, help create better, more interesting pieces of art, songs, albums, and then find a way to make money doing it.
I don't know. Is it, if you weren't doing this, what would you have, what path would you have taken if you wouldn't have taken the path of being an A&R and publishing? And
well, was a drummer, I never had a plan B. I'm like, I'm going to be a drummer. Quit school, I'm going to be a drummer. I learned how to play on the job. I'm not formally trained. I didn't go to school to be a drummer. I've had to fake it till I make it, you know? And fortunately, you know, listening to records like Charlie Watts and that kind of stuff, and Ringo, I learned how to play. And, you know, Al Jackson Jr., Max Roach, all these great drummers. But I learned to play off listening to it. And when we would be on the road with my band, I always like meeting people. I like people. You know, I'm social. So I would meet them at the radio station, college radio, commercial radio, at gigs, and go to the record company. I'd always meet everybody and stay in touch with people. So when I finally got my shot, I did have some contacts. And so sometimes my friends will say, oh, you have it so easy, or what a great job. You get paid to go see shows or go to the studio. I said, no, it is a great job. But make no mistake, I have to work very, very hard. Our songwriters work hard. The artists work hard. You know what it's like, Bernie.
Yeah, yeah.
You see what people do every night. So I have to match their. I've told the artists and songwriters, no one will ever care more about their career than that. If they don't care, I can't care more than that. So they set the pace. But the artists, you know, whether it's Chris Martin from Coldplay or Bono or Jagger Richards or who I mentioned, Dua Lipa, you know, she clearly works hard. When you see how hard they work every day, or look at Miley Cyrus winning a Grammy, she is a grinder. She works so hard. I'll try to match that effort. And so all that experience as a musician, as a person hanging out, everybody I met, it all went into that pot, that gumbo pot stirred up. And to be honest, I never had a plan B. I didn't want to be a doctor or an attorney or a plumber or an astronaut or an author. I don't want to do nothing except this, play rock and roll. And then A&R just to me was just an extension of being a creative musician.
Plan Bs are dangerous.
I still don't have one.
I think, I something you said a minute ago that, you know, people say, well, I could do that. I saw something the other day and it was one of those inspirational message things. And it said, people who say, oh, I could do that, are the people that never do shit.
I'm with you.
You know, like, you got to work hard, man. Like, I was a musician. I knew that it was a diamond in the rough. You know, that's what you're looking for. But I just wanted to be part of it. I just wanted to be part of it. So, I mean, here we are talking to each other. You know,
it's amazing. You think your day job, which is really a night job, you know, and to work with the musicians you work with and to get them ready to go up and perform. And it's a team, you know, I mean, neither one of you could do it without, it's a very reciprocal relationship. But I know if I come to visit you or some of the other people you work with, and, you know, I'm in your, it's like when guys come, oh, I want to go to a show with you. I'm like, well, I'm not going to show to hang out. Like, I mean, I might hang out, that's part of it, but it's a different kind of hangout.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's, I'm there, I'm working, I'm meeting people, I'm trying to kind of look around, who else is there, who's at the show, is the crowd young, old, are they, what is it? It's all information in. So I
all
said
data.
Yes, like my friends that are that are work. Maybe they're, like I said, a plumber or a, you know, or an insurance salesman. I said, I don't go to your fucking office and sit there and stare at you all day waiting for something to happen. I don't. I mean, in fairness, my job, it might be a little more interesting if, you know, people go to see live music to have fun, you know, but we're working, right? So, so if I'm there with you and hanging out and you're gracious enough to, you know, show me around the office, so to speak, then it's time to move on because everybody's working. You're trying to put a great show on so that the songwriters or the artists, or in this case, everybody has a good experience because there's 15 or 16,000 or 20,000 fans on the other side of where we're all standing, you know, or on the other end of that Spotify link that we're working on that are there to, they're spending their hard earned cash. They want to enjoy it.
You know, it's a privilege to do what we do.
Yeah.
You said earlier, like, I'll ask you this real quick. I know you're really short on time. You learned on the job drumming. Did you have being the Crows being the first band you signed? Did you have a kinship with Steve Gorman, who also kind of learned on the job?
Yes. Those guys, Steve was actually one of the guys that came to see the Long Riders at the two places we first met them. Chris and Steve and Rich was at the 688 Club in Atlanta, which is, I think, gone, but it was a cool rock and roll club. And then another, the Crows were already starting to work. They had a little group called Mr. Crow's Garden. Yeah. And they had played at a club in Jacksonville, Florida, called the Einstein and Go-Go, you know, a little punk rock club. Everything's punk rock. Yeah. And we had a show. They had a show, and we were playing the next night, and they wanted to see the Long Riders. So I remember we pulled up the parking lot and some guy was chasing another guy through the parking lot with a mic stand. He's going to hit him over the head with him. And, okay, great. Welcome to Jacksonville, you know, and they were there. So, you know, we struck up just kind of not a friendship. We just knew each other a little bit. You know, they want to know what kind of, these are younger guys then. Yeah. What kind of amps do you use? And what about this? They were music nerds like us.
Yeah.
You know, and so we said, Greg, go get us some weed or get us some beer or whatever, you know, and they were little kids. But then in 1990 or 91, whenever I signed them, their first record was just starting to go. I was like, hey, those are those guys from Mr. Crow's Garden. I knew them. So we reconnected and I think Steve Gorman's great drummer. I love the way he plays.
He is.
And I know he's had his ups and downs with his bands, and that's bands, you know. Brothers fight.
You said you pulled up and you saw somebody chasing someone with a mic stand, I thought you were going to say that was Chris chasing Rich.
I think you're right. But you know, brothers fight, real brothers fight, and then brothers in a band fight. It's just
Well, man, Greg, I appreciate your time. I'm so thankful to Don that he introduced us. I feel like I have a lifelong friend in you.
Ernie, thank you. Me too. Your podcast is great. I love to talk about it. I hope you and your listeners know that I'm passionate about what I do. I feel great every day. It's the G word, the little G. I'm grateful.
Right on, man.
I could have missed it, and I'm here and to play rock and roll and hang out with people that I love and admire, meet people like you and my friend Don and the artists that I so admire. I'm still in awe of the songwriters. You know, I don't have that. So I'm in awe of what they do. There's nothing, and then there's something. It's like magic, right? Yeah. And they're sorcerers, I think. So I love it, and I am grateful. And man, anytime we get to hang out, it's okay with me, Bernie.
Yeah, I know that. You know, you were so respectful the other night at the show. Like you came in, you didn't walk around, you know, thumping your chest. Like, do you know who I am? Do you know what I've done? You were just a fan, and I sensed it. Because I'm still a fan. I walk out from under the stage and watch the show, and I'm like, holy shit, you know, like I'm here.
I mean, I absolutely agree with you, man. I am a fan first, but I will give you an insider tip for any drummers listening. They ever walk into a session and they're feeling a little bit off, whether it's their band or just a paid session, and they're looking for a way to really let people know where they stand in the session, I recommend two questions. One, would you like this song to go too fast? Two, would you like this song to go too slow? And then everything should be smooth after that. except the dome, man. I'm running this shit.
Right on, right on. Well, man, I got one more question. Our podcast is called Is Breakfast Included? If we were having breakfast, Greg, what would you have?
Well, I love toast, man. How can you toast for the rest of my life? And if I'm not having toast, I'm going to be eating pancakes.
Ah, that's what I was waiting on, man. The night at the show, when we were trying to figure out what we're having breakfast, your wife said, "Do they serve pancakes?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "He's going to be all right."
Yes, sir. I love pancakes and I love muddy waters.
Right on, Greg. Well, Greg, have a great day, man. It was great talking to you.
Bernie, thank you, baby. And I'll see you when the time's right.
All right, man. Be safe out there.
Later.
All right.
Right on. Greg Souders. Man, I told you, they come no cooler than Greg Souders. I met him here through a mutual friend. And like I said, we just hit it off right off the bat. You can find out more about Greg Souders at his Instagram. It's at Greg Souders, longriders.com. That's the longriders, riders with a Y, RYDERS.com, warnerchapelmusic.com, and limited edition musicpub.com. Man, sometimes people come into your life and they just change it, man. You just get this energy from them. You get this vibe and you connect with them. And I've had very few people in my life that have done that. But he was one of them. He's a good dude. He's a good human. And like I said, I'm glad I met him. While you're online checking out what Greg does, go to isbreakfast.com. Check out our YouTube page. Like, subscribe, comment. Go to our Instagram. Check out all those cool pictures we have, man. Comment on them. Tell us what you think of these people. And go to our Apple Podcast site or Spotify or Google or wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe to our podcast. Leave a comment. I want all the comments. I want them. I want all the comments. I want all the stars. So do that. Okay? Oh, and by the way, game hasn't even started yet. So, all right, guys, I am done. Have a great day. We'll talk to you next week.